Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Welcome back to the Irish Economics Podcast. I have a really interesting episode lined up today with Will Quinn of Queen's in Belfast, where we discuss financial markets. In particular, we go through stock market bubbles. We discuss the British bicycle mania, something which up until now I've been unfamiliar with. We talk about big shorts, savvy James Bond villains who have resorted to shady stock market trades, and some other cool stories and nice insight that help explain the complicated trades that go on in the stock market. So it's interesting in the sense that we have some nice stories, but also some nice ways of understanding some of the stuff that goes on in the financial markets. Hopefully we'll have an episode at a later date where we can dig a bit deeper into financial markets in particular. A bit of housekeeping before we kick off. Some of you have inquired about ways to support the podcast and help cover costs. Most of the costs have been covered by my own pocket, and there's been a growing gap as things have gone on. If you'd like to chip in, I've set up a Patreon page at patreon.com/IrishEconPod. There's absolutely no obligation in terms of chipping in. It's very much this podcast feed is a public good, and in general, I'm pretty happy to cover the costs, but perhaps the Patreon might help keep that at a sustainable level. I'm also working on a bonus feed for Patreons where we shine an economic torch on maybe some lighter topics such as things like online dating and blockbuster movies. So that could be of interest if you want to check that out. However, as I said already, the main podcast feed, I see it as a public good and it'll always be free. So, okay. Hello, everybody, and welcome to this episode of the Irish Economics Podcast. I'm joined by William Quinn, who is a lecturer in finance at Queen's University Belfast. Will is an expert on financial booms and busts. Having done extensive research in this area, he's written a book entitled Boom and Bust, A Global History of Financial Bubbles with his colleague John Turner. Booms and busts have been occurring throughout history and appear to be happening more frequently, and this book gives some insight into why they happen and the consequences. Will has also done some digging into the British bicycle bubble of the 1890s, which is a very interesting story that we will also explore. So, Will, great to have you on the podcast.
Thanks.
Hope you're keeping well in the lockdown.
Yes, not too bad. And yourself?
Not too bad, yeah. Home studio all set up here, so it should be all right.
Good.
So, okay, when we're talking about booms and busts, what exactly are they and how did it come about?
A boom and bust, essentially, it's actually really controversial. So different economists have a different idea of what causes them, especially. So if you talk about a boom and bust, generally that just means in financial markets, that just means that the price rises and then the price falls by a lot. But when you start talking about a financial bubble, it gets really controversial and there is no really fully accepted definition. So for a definition, we'll just say a financial bubble is a very large rise in prices followed by a large fall in prices. And sometimes you find when you look into it that there's nothing really strange going on, that all that happened was that the value of the asset rose for perfectly sensible reasons and then it fell for other perfectly sensible reasons. But although there was sort of, like, in general life, most people wouldn't call that a bubble. Like, you wouldn't say there was an oil price bubble if there were sort of some events impacting on the price of oil. We just go from there, and use that as our definition. And if we find that it's not really what most people would describe as a bubble, then that's okay.
So my idea of a bubble would be that the price rises and maybe falls again, but the change in price doesn't reflect the underlying value.
That's how most people would think of a bubble. And that is really I suppose, what you would say that the real definition is. The problem then is like the true value of an asset is unobservable. It's based on like estimates of future cash flows, which you can sort of like look at in the long term and say that those cash flows weren't realized, but that doesn't mean that they couldn't have been realized. So if you take the dot-com bubble, for example, that there's a lot of companies that were valued very highly and very quickly went bust. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't mean that they were always going to go bust. So you'll never be able to prove that the price of the asset exceeded its fundamental value, and therefore you can't actually ever really call something a bubble, not with any certainty anyway.
So we can't really prove for definite whether a bubble happened or not. Have you been able to explore what caused the bubble?
Yeah, we did, yes. So we came up with a model. It's a fairly informal model. We called it the bubble triangle, based on the fire triangle. You know that the fire triangle from chemistry?
I don't. Maybe you could explain.
Taught this in school.
It's a long time since I've done chemistry.
Yeah, it must be a northerner thing. We were taught the fire triangle, which is that a fire begins when you have the three points of the triangle, which are oxygen, fuel, and heat.
Oh yeah, sure.
Whenever all of those three elements are present, and you have and you then have a spark, a little ignition, then you get a fire. So we came up with something based on that, which we called the bubble triangle.
Right.
And the three sides of it were, so marketability, which is linked to liquidity. You get a bubble in assets that can be easily bought and sold. And you very often find that before a bubble, you see an increase in marketability.
Okay.
That some assets that were previously quite illiquid, quite hard work to buy and sell, suddenly become very easy to buy and sell. So there's something like mortgage-backed securities. You take mortgage loans, which are very, very illiquid assets that belong to the bank and they can't get rid of them easily. And then you repackage them into securities that can be bought and sold in secondary markets.
Right.
That's an increase in marketability. Second side then is money and credit. So this is very widely observed that you are much more likely to get a bubble whenever it's easy to borrow money, where you can sort of like invest in a risky asset with someone else's money quite easily.
Okay.
And also when there's abundant money, so low interest rates, closely linked with the emergence of bubbles. And then the final point of the triangle is speculation, which is this probably the most difficult one to measure, but this strategy of buying an asset because you expect its price to rise rather than for its future cash flows.
Sure.
And this is always present, so sort of similar to it's similar to heat. I think we thought oxygen was closest to money. Because money is essential and it's a good thing in most contexts, but you can't have too much of it in certain circumststances. But we had speculation as heat, and essentially this is sort of what causes the prices to rise, or we judge to be beyond fundamental values. It is usually this, a lot of people pursuing the strategy of buying and selling the financial asset, or by just buying the asset because they think its price is rising, or because they think its price is going to rise. Again, like closely linked to momentum trading as well.
Sure.
So those are the three points then. And then we find that the spark in all of the bubbles we looked at, the spark only came from one of two places. So the first one was technology. Again, this was very widely observed before that bubbles are closely linked with new technology. So the dot-com bubble, the bicycle mania, which I looked at. They're all linked to sort of serious technological developments that could create a lot of excitement, often create very high initial profits at existing firms that use that technology, get a lot of growth, get a lot of uncertainty. So these assets become very, very difficult to value, which makes them ideal for speculating. And then the other source of a spark that we found was politics. So you would get deregulation often, would sort of create this initial rise in prices that attracts momentum traders, or you could have like specific policies that are designed to increase asset prices, usually because it benefits the group in society that the ruling party or the ruling coalition requires in order to keep power. So homeowners, for example, very often homeowners are a key part of a political coalition, and if you manage to increase the price of housing somehow, then you're redistributing wealth towards your own political coalition. Which is obviously one of the sort of key planks of holding on to power.
It's interesting because it sort of strikes me that you have a sort of an equilibrium, and then something, there's a little bit of a change, and then people respond, perhaps over-respond. If you have, say, like a mortgage has changed to mortgage-backed securities, and then you have a lot of liquidity, people can afford to respond. People are able to respond, and this sort of that's what can sort of spark the departure from the value.
So the most famous model of bubbles previously was Charles Kindleberger's, which is, again, very informal. It's not something that could be quantified. It's actually like a cycle, he describes it in, I think, five stages. And the first of his stages of a bubble he calls displacement, which is exactly what you describe, just this sort of event that changes things and kicks it off.
Maybe we can go into the British cycle mania and just discuss how that came about, and then might help put some flesh in the bones. So you did a lot of research into the British bicycle boom. Maybe you could just give us some background as to how it came about and what the whole scenario was like. Because we all think of bicycles as being there and have been there forever. But the bicycle as we know it today is only really a little over 100 years old.
So previously, if you think of bicycles in the 19th century, you probably imagine these like penny farthings, right?
Yeah.
With the giant front wheel and the sort of very basic frame. These were pretty terrible. They were very dangerous. So
I can imagine if you fall off a penny farthing, it's a long way to the ground.
Right, exactly, yeah. And they don't have any suspension, that they don't have pneumatic tires. So they just sort of rattle along very uncomfortably. The most comfortable model, or a model that was sort of famously one of the best penny farthings, was nicknamed the Bone Shaker.
Yeah.
Because it was just so difficult to ride and so uncomfortable. These were, they would often hit potholes on the roads, and people would go over the handlebars a lot.
Yeah, and roads wouldn't be the same as what we're used to nowadays.
Right, exactly. There were a lot of potholes out there. So they weren't very good. They weren't very widely used. I sort of compare them to like Segways. You'd see them, the same type of person who would ride a Segway today.
Right, okay. That puts it into context.
Yeah. So they weren't very widely used, that they weren't very popular. And in the 1880s, you suddenly see a lot of rapid improvements. So you get the pneumatic tire, and you get the diamond frame, so the same structure, the same shape of bicycle that we see today.
Right, okay.
The chain, so the chain means that you know, you don't need this giant front wheel anymore.
Okay, so the chain seems to be really, that was a really important development in that.
We're moving into physics now, but it's sort of like a lever, isn't it? In that you, yeah. you don't need the big front wheel. Makes life a lot easier when it comes to pedaling.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. One of the main early companies was called the Lever Chain because that's what it was doing. It was acting as a lever, just eliminating the need for this large front wheel.
Right. Okay.
So within a few years, I had some pictures of this, which we were going to put in the book, but we couldn't find the copyright for them. But you just see that very starkly. That from between about 18 years.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Today, and about 1886, you go from the penny farthing design to something which it basically looks exactly the same as bicycles today.
Right.
And that's when, just a few years after that, when sort of people realize just how good these machines are and how useful they really are, you get a cycling craze.
Okay, so all of a sudden everybody is buying, like, bikes are the thing to have, and it's a bit like maybe smartphones taking off. All of a sudden, within a year or two, everybody has one.
Right, exactly, yeah. So what I looked at then, so this is around 1895. You see this, like, sudden increase in demand for bicycles. And what I looked at in the British Bicycle Mania, I don't know a lot about bikes. My research was all into a resulting bubble in the shares of bicycle companies.
Right.
Which runs from, it starts very, very rapidly in 1896, and sort of stays high until about a year later in 1897, and prices stay high, and then very gradually falls, prices very gradually fall for about 10 years after that.
So at this point, so everybody's buying bikes, and so everybody wants to invest in a bike company, and the value of the shares go up. Is that pretty much the idea?
Yeah, pretty much. So they are making a lot of money, and this sort of obviously causes the share prices to rise by a lot, and you also get some mergers, some high-profile mergers. So the Dunlop Company is formed with a new capitalization. It's bought out and refloated for a much higher sum. This obviously means that like spectacular profits for early investors, people that had bought into these bicycle shares early, and this is what attracts people.
Sure. So just to maybe take a step back, so all these companies are floated on the stock exchange, presumably to raise capital to develop a bit further, and then there's trading going on
as like secondary trading between individuals based on what they expect the value of the company to be.
Yeah, exactly. So they're traded on the markets, like, and there are some companies already trading, and these are the ones that initially experienced this boom in share prices. Whenever you get a boom in share prices, it makes capital cheaper for any new companies that want to come in.
Right. Okay.
Because a high level in the equity market means a high willingness, essentially, for investors to buy shares. And if a lot of people are willing to buy shares, it's going to be cheaper to raise money that way. So a lot of private firms, just float on the stock market to raise more money.
So because one or two firms that are there are getting good price for the shares, that means it other companies are looking around and saying, well, if we float, we can get that price that they're getting. Putting the economist hat on, you would think that if more companies come in, that would have drive the price down. But
that is exactly right. Yeah. No, and I think that's one of the main puzzles in a lot of bubbles, including the British bicycle mania.
Right.
Because I say that the bubble lasts, or share prices stay high for about a year. And at the early stage, there's only a few companies, and some of them are, you know, making a lot of money. So the prices do still look high, but if you squint a bit, they don't look ridiculous, right?
Right. Okay.
But then a year later, in 1897, these prices are still high, but you have hundreds and hundreds of companies trading on the stock market.
Right.
And you have the exact puzzle that you identified there, is that why are prices still rising even though, you know, the supply of shares is just continues to rise?
Yeah.
Which obviously is eventually there is a crash, but take a little longer than you would expect.
So in one of your papers I read there that you were discussed this issue of myopic rationality, and maybe you could explain what that means. Would that be one explanation as to why the prices stayed higher than maybe you might think there would be?
Myopic rationality, yes. So this is Gareth Campbell. This is his idea.
Right.
He wrote a paper about myopic in the railway mania. So it's not a debate that I particularly like or that I think is useful, but the, one of the main debates on financial bubbles is whether they're rational or not. And Gareth's contribution is to say, like it's a sort of more nuanced approach to that. To say that investors have their pricing models that they use, and they tend to work well, at least up to the railway mania, and would still work well in the 1890s at the time of the bicycle mania. And these models are essentially based on dividends. So you look at what the current dividends are, the way, you know, technology firms are today, where they don't pay much dividends at all. This was very rare at the time, so dividends were a pretty good measure of how profitable a firm was, and all of the pricing models were based on the current level of dividends. And what he says was that, you know, that this is myopic rationality. It's like it's rational in the sense that it makes sense. It's sort of logically consistent, but it's also myopic in that, yeah, it's short-sighted, that they can't see very far into the future, so they have no idea what the price is going to be next year. The year after that, or what the dividend payments are going to be, next year or the year after that, and therefore, you know, their pricing models don't work in these circumstances.
Yeah.
But that's not the same as saying that they're irrational. And I this is one of the reasons I don't like this debate, is that I think irrational is quite poorly defined.
Sure.
So people would disagree on what constitutes rational or irrational behavior, but in the sense, it's not, you know, for some people irrational seems like crazy, and it's not crazy, it's just you're short-sighted, or you're using a pricing model which you can't apply.
Yeah, sure, you don't have full information, because that makes sense,
right? Yeah,
that makes sense to me, because if you think about it, you're on the threshold of this new technology, you don't know what's coming down the line. You only have, the only information you have at your hand, at to hand, is what's been happening today or tomorrow or maybe in the last year or so. So based on that, and you project for, even if you did sort of project forward from there, you think, well, the only way is up. Now, we know with the experience of the last few years that isn't, or dot-com bubbles, or even, we know that, that's not always the case, but I can see how it could happen.
Definitely, yeah. And as I say, it's an example of this sort of key reason why bubbles are associated with technology is uncertainty. And so in some of my papers, I value that there are various explanations for why technology is linked to bubbles, but they all agree that uncertainty plays a major role, just that these assets are just very difficult to value correctly.
Especially back then where, you know, you didn't have the same access to information that we have now. You had to really dig hard to find, to do your research, whereas nowadays, well, there's probably too much information with the internet that it's hard to find the good information. But even the dot-com bubble, which is on the threshold of internet.
Yeah, definitely. And the other thing about bubbles, so in finance, we normally talk about the limited participation puzzle. So most of the time, it's kind of seems irrational that more people don't invest in stocks.
Right.
So these bubbles are really like aberrations. This very, very rare instance where people are investing more money in stocks than they should. But as I say, it's an aberration. Everyone sort of knows, and maybe they can look down on people that lose money in a bubble, but it's actually a much, much more common mistake to not invest enough. Definitely the more you look at it, you become more and more sympathetic towards these investors, that they're not idiots.
So when you were examining the bicycle bubble, you tried to fit a few theories as to what was explaining what was going on. Maybe could you bring us through that?
Yeah, sure. So I looked at two theories. There were a couple of main competing theories as to why bubbles and technology are linked. So one of these was by Carlota Perez, and she basically argued maybe what most of us would intuitively think, which is essentially that technology leads to financial bubbles because people get very excited about the new technology. You get high initial profits at existing technology firms, and this attracts momentum traders. And you get what she would call a decoupling between share prices and fundamentals. So at a certain point, you get an initial rise in prices, which makes sense because it's based on the high profits at these firms, but at a certain point, like the excitement and the momentum trading that these high profits attract cause prices to rise by too much, essentially they overshoot the true value.
Right. Okay.
So that's Perez's explanation, and then the other explanation was by Pastor and Veronese, to Lubos Pastor and Pietro Veronese, who are two economists at the University of Chicago. And they're much more within the efficient market school, as you'd expect from at the University of Chicago. And they argue that what looks like a bubble is actually sort of a trick or an artifact. So what they argue is happening is that no one is sure that the new technology involved is going to be widely adopted or not. And this uncertainty, so this uncertainty affects cash flows, which people are very aware of. You don't know how profitable these firms are going to be in the future. But it also affects the discount rate, because if the technology is widely adopted, shares associated with the new technology asset will lose their idiosyncratic risk benefits. So if you think of, say, technology firms in the 90s, they tended to be disconnected from all of your other investments, that they weren't closely correlated with what was happening in the wider economy. And this makes them very valuable. So it's sort of valuable above and beyond the amount of money they can give you, because they have like major diversification benefits. What happens as the technology starts to become widely adopted in this Pastor and Veronese model, as the technology becomes widely adopted, the first thing you see is positive cash flow news. So more and more people are using the technology. This causes the price of shares to rise because there's positive cash flow news. The existing firms are making a lot of money. But what you see after that, as the technology becomes even more widely adopted after that, it starts to become integrated within the wider economy. And whenever it becomes integrated within the wider economy, it loses this idiosyncratic risk benefit, where its returns start to become more correlated with the returns on all of the other assets in the economy. And as a result, this causes the price to fall. So you get a rise in prices for positive cash flow news, and then you get a fall in prices because of negative news about the discount rate, about how correlated the returns are going to be with all of your other investments. So those are the two theories. And what I do in my paper is look at the bicycle mania, which is a technological it is a technologically driven bubble. And what I argue in the paper is that the problem with the two theories, so you had these two competing theories, they're both basically consistent with all of the evidence. Which one you believe depends on your prior. So academic financial economists have a strong prior in favor of market efficiency, so they're more inclined to believe Pastor and Veronese. Whereas a lot of practitioners, generally speaking, if they believed in efficient markets, they wouldn't be practitioners.
Right.
Yeah. So they would tend to be much more willing to buy into this idea that markets, sometimes the price is wrong, and they're a lot more sympathetic towards Perez, very, very generally speaking, of course.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
So it really sort of, like, which one you choose to accept would largely depend on your priors and how you view financial markets generally. What I tried to argue was that the British bicycle mania is sort of an argument by counterexample. Pastor and Veronese's argument doesn't apply, or that you can get a technological bubble in which these dynamics identified by Pastor and Veronese don't occur. And the reason for this is that, well, basically, if you look at the level of idiosyncratic risk in the bicycle share market at this time, it doesn't change. So in the Pastor and Veronese model, this sort of fall in prices after the peak is caused by how correlated the returns on the shares are with all of your other investments.
Yeah.
But in the cycle mania, the beta just doesn't change. So you have this sort of boom and bust in a new technology industry, in which we can sort of rule out this these Pastor and Veronese dynamics.
Right.
Okay. And as I say, this is a sort of counterexample. So if you have a situation where there's a boom and bust, and this theory you can pretty clearly say doesn't apply, it suggests that the main factor is probably something else.
Okay, so another thing you touched on in your paper was a lot of the dynamics at play that sort of accelerated the bubble effect during the British bicycle bubble. And one thing that came into play was short selling. So before we get into the dynamics around the short selling, maybe you could, for those who haven't seen The Big Short, maybe explain what exactly short selling is.
Yeah, The Big Short's a great movie. I love The Big Short. It's sort of a catch-all term for the various ways in which you bet against the stock, bet that the price of an asset is going to fall.
Yeah.
So there are a few ways that you can do this. The most common way in modern markets is to borrow the stock and then sell it. So the idea is that you borrow it and you sell the borrowed stock, and then you wait for the price to fall. And whenever the price falls, you buy it back, and then give it back to whoever you borrowed from.
Okay. So there's a lot of steps involved. You borrow it, you sell it, you wait for the price to fall, you buy it back, and then you give it back to the person you borrowed from.
Exactly, yeah. That's how it works most of the time. That's how it works in modern markets. You can also do what we would call naked short selling, essentially like a forward contract. You just enter into an agreement without borrowing the stock. You just enter into an agreement to sell a share that you don't own at a specified price, at a specified date in the future. And you haven't borrowed the stock in this example. You've just entered into an agreement.
It's a lot of risk.
Yeah, there's a lot of risk involved. It's generally much riskier. But at the time of the bicycle mania, this was how short selling was done.
Okay, so basically you entered into agreement to sell it at some date in the future. You haven't got the stock. You haven't bought whatever it is you agreed to sell, and in the meantime, you have to procure that item, and you're exposed to whatever the price is going to be, whenever you have to buy it.
Exactly, yeah.
When you start, you're assuming, okay, well, I'll get it at a reasonable price, but that's not always the case.
The price can go up as well as down, and your theoretical losses are unlimited. So it's in a bubble, one of the things people like about a bubble, and something that actually Pastor and Veronese argue in another paper, is that one of the main appeals of dot-com stock, and one of the reasons why dot-com stock was so high, was because your theoretical gains are unlimited. You know, something could be the next Microsoft or Amazon, as an example, whereas the losses are set at the price of the share. You just buy a share, which might not be very expensive and might be very affordable to lose that amount of money. So you've got this sort of upside potential with low downside risk.
Sure.
Whereas whenever you short sell, and especially if you're short selling, a new technology firm, it's the opposite. You can lose just literally everything. Just bankrupt yourself. Whereas the upside gains are quite limited.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's good advice for anybody who wants to short sell the market at the moment, if they're thinking about coronavirus and how it might affect the market. But okay, so short selling then, how did that play out when it comes to the bicycle mania?
So the bicycle mania, British stock markets at this time, you had essentially two lists, or sort of two sections of the stock market. There was the official list, which was heavily regulated.
Right.
And you had the special settlement list, which was not, which was almost completely unregulated. And sort of modern theory, we would tend to assume that it's easier to short sell on an unregulated market, because short selling tends to be subject to a lot of restrictions and like investor protection regulations. And in some markets, it's just banned. But what we actually saw during the cycle mania was that this lack of regulation tended to work against short sellers. And the reason for this was because there were market corners. Cornering the market, is that something that most people would be familiar with, or is this something...
Maybe we could go into it if you have a quick explainer.
Yeah, okay, cornering the market. It's essentially just buying up a controlling stake. It was similar to a monopoly. There was a James Bond villain in Quantum of Solace who cornered the market for like a Bolivian water supply. Which was not one of the most exciting Bond villain schemes, but
they're running short of ideas now that the Cold War has ended, I think.
Yeah, I know. I mean, your classic Bond villains plot to like blow up the moon or something, but now they're just we're going to corner the Bolivian water supply.
So you've cornered the market. Basically, you can set your price. You have the supply. You can control the supply of whatever the good or service is, and you can essentially set your price then.
Exactly right. So in a financial market, this generally applies to short selling. So you short sell a stock, and someone hears that you've short sold the stock, and they buy up a controlling stake in it. And then when your contract comes due at the end of the short selling period, you go and buy the stock from this person who's engineered a corner, who has a controlling stake. And as you say, they can essentially name the price. So it's just another reason why short selling can be very risky in an environment where corners can happen. And then they do still happen today, just very rarely. So a Volkswagen stock was cornered about 10 or 15 years ago. And this led to Volkswagen briefly becoming the most expensive, the largest company in the world, because the price was risen so high.
Okay, so how exactly would you corner a stock in the modern scenario?
Yeah, essentially by controlling the stakes. So just buy all or almost all of the shares. You're going to need very deep pockets to do this in a large company. It's much more common in small companies or in thinly traded companies. It was much more common historically. American stock markets in the 19th century were notorious for a lot of people trying to engineer corners, even though it wasn't usually very profitable. It didn't usually work very well, but I think it was just a lot of fun. So a lot of these stock market operators would try to engineer a corner.
So this happened in the bicycle boom in that you had these short sellers. Now, correct me if I get this wrong. So they're expecting the price to go down. So they're going to short. They're going to promise to sell at a future date. They haven't bought the stock. So it's, as you say, it's a naked short sell. Then all of a sudden they're reaching this point where, okay, I have to sell this to somebody now, and I don't have something, so I have to go to the market to buy it. Meanwhile, somebody else has bought up all the shares, and then they're saying, "Well, I'm going to name my price now."
Yes, exactly.
Okay. And there was a few occasions where this happened.
Yeah, so it happens three times. In the bicycle mania, it happens three times. Always on the thinly regulated special settlement part of the stock market. So there's one point where a company called Tubes America, where short sellers get let off the hook because we wait to see what happens instead of buying back the shares, sort of. Say okay, well, you know, we'll see if they want to take us to court to get this payment back. And while they're waiting, the company decides to abort its share issue. The shares essentially they're all returned to the original subscribers, and all of the contracts are voided, and the short sellers get off the hook.
Right.
But in the other two corners, the short sellers lose a lot of money, and in one of them, the short sellers lose a huge amount of money.
Right, okay.
It's like absolutely enormous losses.
And as you say, they were exposed to all this risk of huge losses. And then, but there was a ceiling on the amount of profits they could make. So yeah, it really was a bad bet.
It was a bad bet. So I had this example. There was an example that led to a court case. And this guy, Mr. Hamlin, he short sold the shares of a newly issued company. He said he'd done it accidentally, that he didn't mean to short sell. He short sold it by mistake. But if he had sort of pursued this strategy and it had worked as planned, he would have earned a profit of 26 pounds. But there was a corner, and he was forced to buy from a market manipulator who had bought up a controlling share in the stocks, and as a result, his loss was about £2,300. The chance of a corner doesn't have to be very large for investors to worry about it. Your worst case scenario is really bad.
Just, I suppose, before we wrap up, you covered other booms and busts in your book. Is there anything else that maybe strikes you as interesting that might be worth talking about?
I think so. So one of the things we found is like a bubble's not always a bad thing. It's sort of generally very often described with very normative language. You know, it's like a disaster, and then anytime there's a crash, it's sort of you get these debates about what people should do to prevent bubbles and so on. But we actually found that in more than one of the bubbles, one of which was the bicycle mania, you could make a pretty strong case that it was positive. So take the dot-com bubble, for example. What you get with the dot-com bubble is a lot of money flowing into these really innovative firms, and many of which end up adding a lot to the economy. So, exactly. So you think where we'd be now in isolation without some of these firms that were formed during the dot-com bubble and without the level of the amount of money that they were able to raise because of the dot-com bubble.
So the dot-com bubble, if you had a company like Amazon, and they, I don't know if they floated during the dot-com bubble, but if they did, then maybe they could get more capital from the initial public offering. But then the price fell on the secondary market, so they didn't lose out. It was the people who were trading off the back of the value lost out. So therefore, they got more capital and then they could invest and grow because of the bubble. Is that right or wrong?
Yeah, I mean, that's the ideal scenario, yes. So some companies were sort of banking on the need and the ability to raise more capital in the future. So there were companies that the share price falls and then they go bankrupt because they can't raise any more money. But you do get companies that, like I say, Amazon's share price fell. You could pick up Amazon stock for very, very cheap about a year after the dot-com bubble. But the company keeps going. And as we've seen, sort of comes back and does very well in the long term.
Yeah. No, that is a very interesting insight. Absolutely. And just, okay, so maybe we'll just wrap up on one question. After talking about booms and busts, and it sort of it puts a lot more color on, for me anyway, on what constitutes a boom and a bust. And we think about maybe perhaps 2008, and we have is quite clearly something related to more closer to boom and bust than maybe what's happening now. And that I'm just saying this for the benefit, like people might be comparing, well, are we facing another recession like what we had in 2008? But the fundamentals are very different, and given your discussion of booms and busts, it sort of makes that clear, I suppose, for people.
Yeah, so I mean, what we have now is just like an external shock. Yeah. And you know, we also see a lot of government intervention to prevent share prices from falling. So, there are people that argue that we've been in a bubble in everything as a result of this. What started with quantitative easing and now again with large scale government guarantees.
Sure.
In effect, but it is, I don't think it's the same. So we don't see so much speculation. I don't see, we didn't see it like very wide increase in participation, for example. The most recent example of a bubble or a boom and bust would be probably the Bitcoin bubble of 2017. So that was a very recent example where you did see this increase in participation and, you know, people buying, like admitting they were buying because the price was going up, just a pure speculative trading strategy.
Yeah.
Whereas what we see now, I mean, we see a crash, but that's because there's bad news. It's a sort of these companies aren't going to be making much money for a while, so the share price falls down.
No, that is really interesting, actually. The Bitcoin one is definitely, anyone I know who's invested in Bitcoin was definitely speculative. I don't know anybody who or gambled in Bitcoin to be more. I think.
Yeah, I mean, you have true believers as well. You know, people that are like, this is the money of the future, and that's why they own it. And they just sort of buy it and hold it and expect that one day we'll all use Bitcoin instead of dollars and pounds. But I do think most people were sort of doing it for a bit of back, essentially.
Exactly.
As one of my students said when I asked why he'd invested in Bitcoin.
Yeah, no, I think that sums it up nicely. All right, well, I think we've covered everything. That was really interesting. Filled in a lot of gaps when it comes to understanding and some interesting stories. So thanks a million.
All right, yeah, thanks for having me.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.